The Brendan O'Connor Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Advice and expertise on the relief you need from hay fever at All Care Community Pharmacies across Ireland.
Professor Niall Moynagh from the School of Health and Human Performance in DCU, good morning. And let's leave that aspect of things behind for a minute. In terms of the pandemic in general, I suppose we have started in the last couple of weeks kind of looking at, as we hopefully ease out of it, what happened there, what's to be learned from it and everything else. You think that the pandemic has been a big wake-up call for humanity and that it's around that modern society, technology and the way we live our lives is making us sick?
Well, first of all, good morning. Look, we have known for some time, you know, technology is wonderful. It has enabled us, you know, to live lives that were unimaginable even 20 years ago. But the other side of the coin is that it is making this generation sicker and unhealthier than any previous generation. And what the virus has clearly illustrated, the two key risk factors for getting sick, being hospitalized or dying with the virus are age. And the second one is chronic diseases. And these are common chronic diseases that are primarily lifestyle mediated. Now, going back to the first one, even aging, I think we have to really, you know, there is now evidence starting to accumulate that maybe it's not this inevitable. We shouldn't see this inevitable deterioration in bodily functions, because it's now presumed with our understanding of aging, in 50 years' time, people will look back and say, Jesus, they only lived to 80 in the 2000s. And I think because we tend to look at disease in a singularity, it's either heart disease or cardiovascular disease, but we fix one, then another one appears. So yeah. I think we shouldn't start thinking about aging when you're 60. We need to start thinking about aging much, much earlier, because we do understand at the cellular and molecular level how genes are activated. I think that's a story that I think is going to emerge from this as well, because why were the elderly people so affected by it? And we know there are lots of reasons for that. The second one then is...
So hang on, let's stay with that a second. So what you're saying is that if we put in the work early in our lives, we do not have to be frail when we are older. Is that what you're saying?
There's no accumulating evidence to suggest that.
What can we do?
Well, obviously, very, very, our lifestyles will have a big influence on that. And we know that, you know, if you look at the areas of the world where people live into their hundreds, there's commonality there, particularly in their diets, their vegetables, legumes. They don't eat a lot of carbohydrates, meat, dairy. So, and that's both in Europe and in Asia, we see that.
Okay.
We know that sleep is a big, big impact on our health. Obviously, exercise, our chronic levels of stress, alcohol consumption, and these are all modifiable risk factors that we can actually control. Now, what we will also be able to do, probably within a quarter of a century, is to be able to do a genetic profile on someone when they're born, to be able to predict you're at increased risk, you have the gene variants that likelihood is that you're going to increase risk for dementia or other issues.
Yeah.
And for those people, we can individually tailor and say at a young age, actually, you cannot smoke, because if you smoke, the likelihood is you're going to get chronic lung disease much earlier than someone else.
And do we have that kind of, do we have that science and that information? Because remember the Human Genome Project, we thought all of this was going to flow out of it, and then it kind of seemed to kind of peter off into obscurity a bit.
Well, the Human Genome Project was not
looking at that kind of thing?
Not really.
Misunderstanding. Okay.
Yeah,
that was
just looking at the genes. In fact, we only looked at genes that were a certain base length. We didn't look at a lot of other genes are only being discovered now.
Okay.
And we thought it was junk DNA. And in fact, we realize now that it's very, very important.
And is that science starting to come on stream now?
Yeah, I think the issue is, though, we work in silos. You walk into a hospital, you have the cardiology unit in one, you have the immunology in the next, and you have, you know, they're all different. But they fix one disease and then another disease, you know, because before the age of 50, if you smoke, the likelihood is you're a fivefold increased risk of getting cancer. If you live to the age of 50, you have a hundredfold increased risk of cancer. You live to the age of 70, you have a thousandfold increased risk of cancer. So we need to take a totally different view of how we look at aging. Instead of this being this inevitable deterioration of bodily functions, I think what modern science will allow us to live much, much healthier lives. We're at the precipice of this now, but I think the future is really exciting. And I think this pandemic has brought this home, because what annoyed me was, oh, they're old, it's inevitable, they're in a home, they should die. Yeah. I mean, that's ridiculous.
Yeah.
It's absolutely ridiculous. And I think we need to change our thinking on that.
Okay. And the second strand to it then?
The second strand is obviously the common chronic diseases. And, you know, these have been emerging obviously since the Industrial Revolution, but they've picked up since the Technological Revolution. We're engineering activity out of our lives. We're becoming more and more sedentary. And if you go back and look at COVID, there was a large study done on 50,000 people. And basically what they showed was, if you were inactive, compared to someone who got their regular 150 minutes a week of brisk walking, if you were compared to those, if you were inactive, not getting your 150 minutes a week, more likely to be hospitalised, to go to intensive care, and to die compared to someone who was physically active. But more importantly, activity was a better predictor than your blood pressure, your diabetes, whether you were overweight. And why is that? Because we know that when you exercise, it has a positive effect on all of these body systems, and we've engineered it out of our lives.
So it was simple as that. Movement was the key there.
And that's the key word. People use the word exercise. We need to use the word movement. As long as we're not sitting or lying, we're being physically active and moving. We have engineered that out of our lives, even you know, with the pandemic and more people at home sitting at desks for longer and longer periods of time.
And like, not just the adults, like the kids as well.
Well, and that's, you know, most people think that, you know, I'm young, you know, I'm not going to get a chronic disease. But most of these chronic diseases start very, very early in life. We've known this, for example, in heart disease. We've known since the Korean War and the Vietnam War, when they did autopsies on the young American soldiers, they saw these large fatty lesions. And then they went back and they did autopsies in kids who have died in motor vehicle accidents. And we see kids who are inactive, poor diet, they have evidence of these fatty plaques in their arteries as young as 6 to 9 years of age. So don't think it all of a sudden you get to 30, 40 years of age when you start developing chronic diseases. And the problem now is the kids are being exposed to these risk factors at an earlier and earlier stage than previous generations.
Okay. Now, in the immediate term, going back to the older people, one of your concerns, and you've expressed it in passing here before, is that older people in particular regaining their independence after the last year.
Yeah, you know, and it's funny when you're in your 60s, you start to think of it aging very, you take it a lot more seriously.
Yeah, okay.
But you know, yes, and as we age, one of the things we have to do, and a lot of older people don't realise this, people talk about your walk and your cardiovascular health. Your muscles are the biggest organ in your body. You have to preserve your muscle, because once you start losing muscle, you become frail and you lose that independence. And the other thing that happens as we age, we become what's called anabolically resistant. That means if I go and do a weight training session in my 70s and I have a young person who's doing the same weight training session in their 20s, the person in their 20s will put on a lot more muscle. We become resistant to that. And the same when we take protein in our diet, we don't put on the same amount of muscle. So maybe they need to do it more often during these small little micro bouts of exercise and taking more protein during the day to maintain that muscle mass. But the good news is that even in your hundreds, you can increase your muscle mass.
It can come back. Yeah.
The problem is, it's by doing nothing, that's the issue. That's why we're losing our muscle. Because if you're sitting in a long-term care facility or at home for prolonged periods of time, the bottom line is you're losing muscle.
Yeah. So look, you would echo what Dr. Holohan has been saying. Those older people need to get back out there now. And you can see that a lot of them are slightly afraid and slightly reluctant and have got into bad habits over this and got maybe a bit comfortable in their prisons, but they really need to push themselves.
Yeah, and there's
back
a lack of,
there.
You know, you're right, lack of self-efficacy and the belief that they can actually go out and do this. I have my own dad, he turns 92 this month, walking up and down the landing, you know, on a regular, he's getting physio now because he was sitting for prolonged periods at home and his muscles were wasting.
Yeah.
And he's
yeah.
seeing the benefits already, you know, within 2 weeks.
Listen, just a bit of practical stuff for the general population out there. A lot of people talk about this COVID stone they've put on over the last year. And look, I'd say now the newspapers will start as we start coming into the summer, getting the bikini body back and all that and the 8 week plans and Michael Mosley and all that kind of thing. You have a very simple kind of an answer for people, don't you, as to what to do if they want to lose a bit of weight. It's calories in.
Well, look it's the law of thermodynamics. It's calories in, calories out. But the good news is, look, even without COVID, we all tend to put on a few pounds over the winter months anyway. So we're all used to that. And as the weather gets good, we tend to spend less time at home in sedentary situations. And I think the first thing is, if you're not at home sitting, the likelihood is you won't be eating. And I think if you're going to lose weight, it's primarily about calories and not about exercise. Exercise is wonderful to maintain a certain body weight. But if you want to lose weight, you burn so few calories. And like in a 30-minute walk, you're going to burn around 180 to 200 calories. Like that's two slices of bread when you get back home again, to put it in perspective.
Yeah.
So it's a case of just eating. And to give a practical example would be, maybe for 2 or 3 weeks, you have a 500 calorie a day deficit. And how do you accumulate that? You get 250 calories through exercise. So go out and walk for 30, 40 minutes. There's 250 calories and eat 250 calories less. That's 500 calorie deficit a day. Over the course of a week, that's 3,500 calories. That's a pound of fat.
Is it?
Yeah.
Okay, simple as that.
Well, no, you have to eat less and you have to exercise more.
But
people think, you know, they think it's a mountain. How do I get over this mountain? You have to start somewhere. And I think the caloric restriction is probably more important than the exercise initially to lose that weight.
Yeah. Okay. You were intermittent fasting the last time you were in. Are you still doing it?
Well, I don't like the term intermittent fasting.
Okay.
Let's say I'm eating less often. I try to put prolonged periods between my meals. And again, that's one of the, you know, we've known now for 50, 60 years that people who actually eat less over a 24-hour period live longer. They have a healthier lifespan.
Okay. You know, look, they're flooding in here. My friend, age 68, smokes 20 a day, never takes much exercise, likes a drink, never gets sick. Ask Dr. Moyner to explain that. Donna, I think he's already explained it. Genes, I presume, like
some
people.
And that's it. But, you know, my answer to that question always is, but all his buddies who are smoking are all dead.
Okay. So listen, in terms of the road that took you to where you are now, because people see that you're obviously not confining yourself to the current thinking on stuff, and you're looking forward and all that kind of thing. And I sense you've always been a bit like that. It started out, I know, you were sport mad all your life. It started out as a PE teacher. But maybe kind of, I wouldn't say a crank at that stage, but that you were always looking elsewhere at what was going on in current thinking and that.
Yeah, I always had, because of my interest in sport, I was self-coached as an athlete when I was very young. And, you know, I remember taking a bus from Monaghan up to Dublin to Hodges Fidges to buy a book on physiology because I wanted to learn how the body worked. And that really excited me. And when I was in secondary school, they used to send around these buses. I was in a boarding school in Dundalk, and they used to send around these buses to check for TB.
Yeah.
So I had a chest X-ray and went back to class. And about 2 weeks later, my parents received a letter that I needed to go to St. Vincent's Hospital immediately to have my heart checked. So I went to St. Vincent's, and there was a cardiologist called Richard Mulcahy, who was really an eminent cardiologist, way ahead of his time.
Yeah.
So he put me on this bicycle and hooked me up to all these gadgets, and I thought this is absolutely fantastic. And he came back and said, you have an enlarged heart. But your enlarged heart, he asked me, did I exercise? And I said, yeah, I was a runner and I played football. He said, it's an adaptive response to your exercise. That's healthy. That is absolutely fantastic. So I asked him a few questions about the leads and what all these things, the ECG, you know, what all this was about. And I left St. Vincent's Hospital and I said, that's what I want to spend the rest of my life doing. I want to figure out how exercise impacts on the body. And my initial interests were purely from an elite sports performance. You know, how can we make athletes better? But then through my studies, I realized that if you really want to stand on the starting line of an Olympic final, you better pick your parents, because you can train until the cows come home.
Really? Yeah.
Yeah. You're not going to be there.
10,000 hours? No.
No, sorry to disappoint you.
Okay.
So I realized.
So you need to be a kind of a genetic freak to use that word.
Actually, that is the term. I mean, to stand on an Olympic final, you really have to be in the 0.00001% of the world's population. Otherwise, we'd all be standing on the starting line of the Olympic final.
Because
we all train hard, but certain people just have the genetics.
And anything they can get from their regimes and all that is incremental, really.
You have to have the basic genetic particularly for individual sports. For team sports, it may be a little bit different. But to stand on the starting line of an Olympic 100-meter final, you know, you really have to have the genetic predisposition to get you there.
Yeah. So physiology probably wasn't a big thing in when you were doing teacher training or that, was it? Like,
well, first of all, you know, during my school, you know, I think this is important because I was the worst student in Ireland up to the age of 15. I didn't open a, I had no interest in school. It just didn't excite me. And then all of a sudden, and I see parents pushing their kids today at a younger and younger age, is going to grind schools. I didn't open a book. I don't think I actually failed my junior cert, you know, because I had no interest in study. And all of a sudden, I found something to put my hat on. And I was good at science, I was good at math. And all of a sudden, I had a reason for studying. And I went from one extreme to the other overnight. So when I went, I made a decision very early. There's two ways I could. There's only one way I could have done it in Ireland, because there was only one PE college. There was no sports science then, so you had to become a PE teacher. And there wasn't a lot of physiology in that. But the physiology I did, I actually thoroughly enjoyed it. And to put things in context, students today would learn more in one semester than I learned in 4 years.
How it has moved on. So you took off to America.
Yeah, I decided when I was in that book I bought in Hodges Fidges was written by an exercise physiologist in America called David Lamb, who was an eminent physiologist. I didn't know at the time, there was no internet. So I looked at the front of the book and I saw he went to Purdue University. So I went to the Encyclopedia Britannica and I looked to see where Purdue University was. This is back in the 1970s.
Yeah.
So I decided, yeah, I'll write to this guy and see. So I wrote to him, he wrote back and said, look, you have to do this graduate record exam and all of these sort of stuff. So, and I did, this is before I went to the University of Limerick. I decided before I wanted to be an exercise physiologist, and this was my way to becoming an exercise. There was the only way I could actually do it. So I did that, got my degree, taught for a year, taught for in Athlone for a year, and then taught in St. McCartan's in Monaghan for 2 years. And then I decided, okay, I'm going to give this a go. But when I went to America, I did not go to America to get a master's. I went to America to get more knowledge.
Yeah.
And that's a huge difference. I wasn't interested actually in the MSc. It was, I wanted just to find out more. And I thought America was the place. They had the labs, you know, wonderful facilities. So I arrived at this place called Purdue University. It's a large university in the middle of a cornfield in Indiana, between Chicago and Indianapolis.
Which your guru was
there. He was there.
Yeah.
And the week I arrived, he left to take a position in Ohio State University. So I never got to work with him. And about 20 years later, I got a fellowship from the American College of Sports Medicine, and he actually presented it to me, and I reminded him of the incident. Obviously he hadn't remembered, but I went to work with him and he left. But look, it was a wonderful experience to go to a very large universities. And I remember the first morning getting my timetable and it said class at 7:30, and I said to myself, that's very late to be going to your first class at 7:30 in the evening. And the guy said, no, it's 7:30 in the morning. So it was a great experience. Purdue was very famous, obviously the first man to walk on the moon, very world famous in aeronautic engineering and globally ranked, you know, in many of its disciplines.
And so did you come back from America then full of kind of newfangled ideas and notions and all that kind of stuff that you'd picked up out there?
Not particularly. Yes, I learned. What it does, it gives you great confidence. So when I came back, I felt, you know, I have a science to back up what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And you know, when you're being taught by people who are publishing the papers and writing the books, you say, well, I probably am up to date as anyone is. And I was very heavily involved in both athletics, and particularly with Monaghan, went on a great run at that time. So I was heavily involved with them. So I was able to take some of the information that I had learned and apply that as well at the time.
And I believe this was in an era when like a GAA intercounty player could put on, like you referred to wintering earlier, like, and how we all put on a few pounds. They'd put on a few stone over the winter. Like there was no kind of year round minding of them and training and conditioning and all that.
Well, a few stone is very conservative.
Really?
Oh yeah. You know, some players could put on 3, 4, 5 stone over the winter, and you come back and you would spend. But you know, that's what the GA was about then. It was a bit of fun. You know, you come back and you spent the first 2 or 3 months getting yourself back into shape. Not the semi-professionals that they are today. So it was a great time to be involved with coaching, and things were really starting to move. I was very lucky. The manager of the Monaghan team was Sean McCaig. He went on to become president of the GAA, and he was, when I was on the pitch, I was 100% in charge. He didn't interfere at all. Game day, he was totally in control. So it was a wonderful relationship, and it gave me great confidence to take all that knowledge that I had learned during my master's and then to apply it.
Yeah, and there was no resistance to you bringing that kind of stuff into the scene, no?
Not at all.
Yeah,
no,
yeah,
no.
Yeah. And listen, I suppose it brings us to another pandemic lesson that you think we should learn as well, which is that you can never spend too much on sport.
You know, it's so true. It's so true. It's, you know, when I hear people complaining about money that the government is investing in sport, you know, the pandemic has certainly taught us the importance of sport to society, not just to those who participate, all those older people living in both rural and urban Ireland you know, who can't wait for the weekend to see their favourite rugby team or hurling team or soccer team. That's part of the social fabric of who we are. They can go down to the local shop and talk about it. That's, that, you know, that's one end that people underappreciate. But the other part is just the ability to get out and to be involved, no matter what the activity is. We can't invest enough in sport. And I've said this many times, you know, when you travel around, and when I take Americans around Ireland and I explain to them what the GAA is about, you know, if it wasn't for the GAA, we would have no sporting infrastructure, because they spent 125 years, all these parishes putting in infrastructure. And now the government has taken over that role in the last 25 years. But, you know, we should never have to defend money spent on sport again, because every money spent on every penny spent on sport is going to have a positive effect on both physical and mental health.
And I know another thing that you believe passionately about sport is in inclusivity, and that certainly would strike a chord with people like me, who, because, like, when, you know, when we were growing up, if you weren't good a lot of the time, you kind of got left behind and that was it. And then you found, we'll say, other interests maybe. But you think it's kind of everyone should get a game is your
ethos. This thing about selecting the perceived best at 10 years of age is absolutely ludicrous. There's none of us can predict what child is going to become an elite athlete. None of us know that. The predictive models are very poor. And when I came back, Dr. Noel McCaffrey, a former Dublin player, and Jack's dad, who's a physician, and he had this belief as well that every child should be afforded the opportunity to play. So what we did in around 2004, we invited all the young kids in Dublin to come to DCU on a Saturday morning. And there was one guarantee that every child who came got to play at least three of these small-sided games.
Yeah.
And I'd say within 2 weeks, I was getting calls from parents telling me that their kids were waking them up at 5 o'clock in the morning in case they were late arriving, because it was the first time they were getting to play and they were coming out of themselves.
And confidence.
So we had to have evidence, you know, for this. So I got Mickey Whelan to do a PhD on this, and that became the evidence that formulated the current Go games that are now that are used by all kids up to the age of 12 and are now being adapted also by soccer and rugby, which I think is very important, because we've got to give every child that opportunity to engage.
And the kids who don't get a game, they're our problem, aren't they? They're our ticking time bomb in years to come. It's not the ones who are good and who are self-motivating and who are involved. They're going to stay involved and be fit all their lives, aren't they?
Well, it's probably not even the kids. It's the coaches and the mentors. It's this instant gratification. I mean, why a coach would want to win an under 12 competition beggars belief. And so it's about deferred gratification. Your job is to create an ecosystem that allows these kids to flourish, you know, and kids will flourish in different ways. Some will be early achievers, but, you know, the most of the great players in most sports actually were late developers, but they were kept in the sport, and we lose so many because of this thing about, you know, wanting to win at an early age. So, but I think that is changing. The culture is certainly changing across all of our major sports.
Do you think we've lost kids in the last year now who've got out of good habits they might have had and stuff? And, you know, there was talk about that they are now involved in more individualistic activities and that they won't want to go back into regulated team sport and all that.
It is a concern, but my anecdotal observations would be, if you go back to St. Vincent's now this morning, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
The kids are out. It's though, you know, they've landed on a new planet. You know, they're hyperactive. And most parents, anecdotally, the feedback I'm getting from parents is their kids have just found themselves again.
Yeah.
So, maybe up to a certain age, but I think there's a teenage group that, you know, they may find other ideas and interests during the lockdown and may not come back. And that would be very, very concerning. I think for me, there's the 20% who will always play sport, but we need to be investing in the other 80%. Mm. And it's not about sport. It's about finding ways for them to be physically active. And as I said before, there are three activities we do all of our life: walk, swim, and cycle. And every child should be able to do all of those things, because you can do those until you're 90 or 100 years of age.
Yeah, listen, I've loads of texts coming in here. There's an email first I'll read you from Pádraig White. Niall Moyne is one of the most inspirational people that has had such a positive influence on my life, from when he taught me PE in St. McCartan's College, Monaghan, not to mention the football training. It must be great to hear that, is it?
It's very gratifying.
Yeah,
very
gratifying. Now, there's lots of people with various kind of questions and stuff. No, we can't answer them all. But my husband had an accident that damaged his shoulders, operations on legs and a pair of new knees. His muscles in legs and arms are bad. Can he build them up now? He's 66. And you could really see how a fella could get old really quickly at 66 when all that happens.
Yeah, without a doubt. Again, that individual has to go to a physiotherapist or an athletic trainer and get specific exercises. to isolate those muscle groups. And again, because they're deconditioned, he will get a tremendous benefit within 4 to 6 weeks of initiating proper exercises.
Yeah, yeah. Someone saying, isn't it crazy park runs are not back yet, or indeed a gym open? I wonder if everyone's going to go back to gyms when they do open. I think people have found all kinds of other ways of things. A texter here says, active travel to school is the silver bullet. Would you agree?
Without a doubt. In fact, I saw that St. McCartan's College Monaghan, one of their former students living in England now, has sponsored a bicycle initiative where the kids now have a safe cycling route to school. And we need to see that in far more, because that's a great way for those kids who don't participate in sport to accumulate their minutes of physical activity, walking to and from school.
Yeah, yeah. Normalises activity, this texter says. You don't have to be sporty, as you say. Yeah. It's inclusive, social, great for children with additional needs. It establishes patterns that will stand to them throughout their lives. No point in ferrying children everywhere to sports activities in a car. I see it myself in my class. The kids who walk, cycle or scoot to school are the ones who arrive ready to learn and are focused throughout the day. Yeah,
yeah, yeah, without a doubt.
Yeah,
without
a bit of activity early in the day. That irony of driving them to sports training then in class. Oh, do I have to walk down there? Like, yeah, yeah. Listen, there were a couple of other things that I wanted to cover with you. One is that you were saying that people need to be a little bit careful getting back into to training and activity now.
Yeah, well, I think that there's two things. First of all, those who have had COVID, you need to be very careful. You just can't come back where you left off. Probably I would give yourself 4 to 6 weeks to gradually work your way back in. Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Because long COVID, and people have different symptoms for long COVID, but just to be safe, I would give 4 to 6 weeks if you've had the virus. For those who, particularly in team-based sports, and even with St. Vincent's, we're back this week, we just did 45 minutes, very, very easy, because the movement patterns that you do in team sports is very different to running in linear fashion. You know, for the last 6 months, you're twisting and turning. So you're using different muscle groups, different ligaments and tendons that probably got weak. So it's probably going to take 2 to 3 weeks to get everything back up to scratch. But we don't want people getting injured as we get back playing again.
One other text here, and I want to read this out because I'm conscious that there's obviously been a huge conversation on Liveline and elsewhere in this country in the past 2 weeks about the menopause, and a woman, I presume, asking, would Niall have any thoughts, experience on enabling older women with menopausal muscle discomfort how to keep active? The pain does not disappear with exercise.
Yeah, again, for some people, they can find an exercise that suits them, particularly initially non-weight bearing exercises, such as cycling with very low resistance or walking in a pool. So putting on one of those buoyant tubes and walking in a pool.
Yeah, which is harder than it sounds, isn't it? Walking up and down the pool.
There's a lot of resistance when you're doing that, yes.
Yeah. You think we'll value the simple things more after all this?
No doubt about it.
Yeah.
It's funny, again, on our first session back on Tuesday night, I turned around and said to Brian Mullins, boy, smell that green grass. You know, when was the last time someone said, boy, smell that green? Because we missed it. The things, the small things, I think, as a society, I think our priorities hopefully will be reorientated. You know, as people say, don't sweat the small stuff. You know, the things that we take for granted, I don't think, certainly in the next year or so, we will not take them for granted again. Going into a shop, you know, and buying clothes and going to the cinema. We just took all of these things for granted in the modern world. I think if there was one thing for me, I think it has shown us up to be somewhat of a selfish society.
Yeah.
I think it's how dare them take away this, that and the other. You know what I mean? Previous, you know, generations of Irish people went home and sat by a hearth at night and had a conversation or a ceilidh. Now it's, you know, these are all these mod cons, and how dare them take away any of these things from us. I think, you know, there are lots of other people.
I think people took a big hit though as well, and a lot of people did. Like, I think as a nation, we were very compliant here, and in a lot of cases, people were doing it for
older people,
weren't they?
I think without a doubt, I think as a nation, we were absolutely fantastic.
Yeah. Niall Moyna, that was fantastic. I think a lot of people got a lot out of that, judging by the wall of text there in front of me. Thank you very much, and talk to you soon. Let's take a break.
Text 51551. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.